Welcome into this Golf Channel podcast special. I'm Will Gray, and in a few moments, our own Tripp Eisenhower will be joined by the man, the myth, the legend, and a very popular follow on Twitter, Club Pro Guy. But before we get to the show, we want to mention that this is a parody account. So sit back and enjoy a very entertaining listen now between Tripp and the man himself, Club Pro Guy.
Welcome to this very special Golf Channel podcast. We're joined by a very special guest today, and before I get to him, I'd briefly introduce him. His name is Club Pro Guy, and he was a Mexican mini-tour legend for many years, and then he turned his talents to the Club Pro world, and recently he started to tell his side of the story because he feels like as a steward of the game, it's very important to get that word out, and he joins us today. We are altering his voice due to the fact that he does have issues with his GM, and of course there's some credit issues and some people, you know, kind of looking for him. So we're trying to protect his identity, but welcome in, Club Pro Guy, to Golf Channel.
Thanks, Clay. Glad to be here.
All right, so first of all, I got to find this out, because most of my friends that turn pro after college, they travel the world to find different competitive tours to play in. Some went to Europe, others to Asia. I personally went to South Africa to hone our games for the PGA Tour. You took a unique path by going south of the border to Mexico. I had no idea at the time they had a mini tour. How did you find out about that tour, and why did you choose that route?
Well, Tripp, looking back, I can't believe how naive I was. You know, I was young, and obviously I had a ton of game, but I just didn't know how it all worked. I didn't know what the process was, and I mistakenly assumed that my high school resume, where I was second team all conference, you know, coupled with my strong regional finishes in the Oldsmobile Scramble in 87 and 88, would be enough for some type of provisional status on the PGA Tour. Now, obviously, I was wrong, so I had to kind of scramble last minute. And I was lucky because my swing coach at the time was an undocumented immigrant and part-time Mexican drug mule who happened to know all about the Mexican mini tour because both of his younger sisters were groupies on that tour throughout most of their teen years. And he had told me it was a tour known for the weakest competition on the worst golf courses for the smaller purses, and he thought that I might have the game for it. So my team's thinking at the time was if I could go down there and dominate that tour, then it would, you know, it would give me the confidence to move on to more competitive tours like the Midnight Sun Tour in extreme northern Canada or the Ground Under Repair Tour in Appalachia, you know, eventually moving on to Asia, then Europe, and then eventually the PGA Tour. Now, obviously, it didn't work out that way, but I think, you know, looking back, my strategy was very sound.
How many years did you play down there?
14 years total, you know, long, wow. Long career for any professional athlete, you know, and it's funny. I look back on those early years now, and I just marvel at how well I hit it. You know, when I had my A game, there were maybe only 100 guys on tour that could beat me. You know, at that time, I was breaking 80 with some regularity. I was able to move the ball left to left and right to right almost on command. My short game was solid. You know, my punch-out game was raw, but showing signs of its future greatness. It was just a fun time to be a tour pro. But really, everything kind of changed for me in 96 when I endured several non-golf-related calamities all at once. You know, the PT Cruiser that my second wife, Brandy, and I were living out of was stolen. You know, I was dealing with complications from an STD. You know, I had just lost a lucrative endorsement deal with a limited flight range ball company. And really, I was never the same after that. I came back and I felt like I lost some passion. I felt like I started playing for the money more than the love of the game, which, as you know, is death for a professional athlete. You know, case in point, I signed a deal in 97 with I Gotcha Golf Ball Retrievers, and it stipulated in the contract that I was paid based on how many times I used the retriever in competition, and it kind of turned into a money grab. You know, at the 98 Tampico Classic, I shot 109 just to rack up golf ball retriever usage opportunities. You know, Hell, Ernesto just walked around the whole day with the retriever fully extended just to make it easy on himself. So, you know, that's certainly an ugly chapter, but overall, I'm very proud of my career down there.
Oh, well, as you should be. Now, your 8-hole par streak is well documented on online and on Twitter.
True.
What other moment or moments are you most proud of during your playing days?
Well, after 14 years, there's a lot of them. You know, if you had to pin me down, probably most notably was at the 94 Tecate Cup when I was asked to deliver the inspirational speech to the guys in the team room the night before the decisive singles matches. And we went 2-9-1 the next day. Individually, you know, I led the tour in 2-putt bogeys and 3-putt pars 11 years in a row. You know, midway through 1990, I went 44 straight holes without missing inside 2 feet.
44.
Wow. You know, in 1994, I passed 4 consecutive drug tests. You know, I played the entire front nine of the 93 Pancho Villa 4-ball without ever saying, "Your hole, Pardsy." You know, that was big for me. At the 01 Carlos Slim, I returned the courtesy car undamaged. You know, I played the entire 95 Toto Santos Classic without making a questionable drop, you know, big for me. You know, over the course of my career, including my junior and amateur career, I was 4-0-2 in paternity suits. So, you know, I'm sure there are more highlights, but those are the ones that kind of come to mind right now.
Okay, yeah. Things to be proud of, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, many have used, I know I have, and many have heard the term, this course is a goat ranch. But few know that that term comes from and was originated on the Mexican mini tour. Mm-hmm. They actually played several events each year on working goat ranches. Talk about those conditions.
Well, that's true, Tripp. That's accurate. And, you know, today's players, you know, especially the prima donnas on the PGA Tour, don't appreciate how spoiled they are. You know, they don't understand what guys like me had to go through. And honestly, for me, I wouldn't have had it any other way because I think those poor turf conditions we played on is what made me such a great ball striker.
Yeah.
You know, unlike the PGA Tour, people don't know this, but unlike the PGA Tour, the courses we played on weren't described by the type of grass they had, but rather what kind of rock was a 16th of an inch under the surface. So Augusta National might be referred to as a ryegrass course. In turn, we would describe Yucatan National as a quartzite course. You know, Torrey Pines is Poana, Monterey Municipal is limestone. Oakmont is bent grass, and Toto Santos Country Club is basinite. You get the idea.
Right, right. Yeah.
So personally, for me, you know, I preferred to play off a travertine because it contained calcite, which allowed me to get a ton of spin on my scoring clubs. You know, I think that's part of the reason I played so well on the Narco swing, because many of the northern courses along the border had travertine fairways. You know, my Cleveland Voss irons used to just take an absolute beating up there. But, you know, I laugh when today's tour players blame the turf for a poor shot. You know, I played off some lies you literally wouldn't believe. You know, I used to beg my ball to roll into a donkey or burrow hoof print because I thought that type of lie was more predictable than the alternative. You know, you want to talk about lies. You know, I'm the guy who had a buried lie in a shallow mass grave at the 01 El Chapo Skins game. You know, and side note, that tournament always made me nervous. You know, instead of presenting a jacket or a trophy, their tradition was to have the winner smoke meth at gunpoint. Wow. You know, scared the hell out of me. But to answer your question, the conditions down there were just terrible.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Wow. Now, on the PGA Tour that I was a member of, we were always asked to do, like, outreach each week in the local communities. It's something the PGA Tour was always very proud of. And as players, we were proud of doing it at each week's tour event. Things like junior clinics, you know, hospital visits, other charity events were commonplace. What type of community outreach did the Mexican Mini Tour do each week?
Well, you know, I would say that charity and giving back was really at the heart and soul of our tour. Now, you know, we obviously didn't have the financial resources of the PGA Tour, but it didn't stop us from giving back. We did lots of things. You know, we had players give autographed balls and gloves to the hungry and malnourished kids in the barrio. We launched the Mental Golf for the Mentally Ill program. You know, we would make a sizable financial donation to local schools for every double eagle that was made on tour. You know, we didn't do hospital visits per se, but we would routinely visit brothels, you know, sometimes for hours or even all night if need be. You know, other than that, drug prevention was big for us. You know, for several months, I had a towel on my bag that had "Say No to Really Hard Drugs" embroidered on it. You know, so we as a tour did our fair share. And for me, that this sense of giving back carries with me even to this day. You know, I will routinely like a Facebook post from a cause that I care about. You know, I, on a regular basis, I donate blood and other bodily fluids for cash. You know, back when it was really popular, I briefly wore one of those yellow Livestrong rubber bracelets. You know, stuff like that, it's the least I can do. And I just think, as a high-profile athlete, I have a responsibility to support important causes, and it's something I try to do every day.
Oh, good. All right. That's nice to hear. Now, unfortunately, we did some digging around. We were trying to find some records and some stats, you know, from the tour, but what we found out, actually, there was an accidental explosion at the Tequila Distillery, which was next to the tour's headquarters. But we were able, they had a few that they had loaded to the Mexican intranet, and we were able to actually dig up, and they kept some pretty interesting stats that I find kind of unconventional, but I noticed that you were consistently at the top of a few of them.
That's true.
So let's just quickly go through some of these and let's talk about it. I saw you were always up there in four putts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is a weird one. Strokes gained punching out sideways.
That's true. And, you know, for me, you know, like Crenshaw's putting or maybe Norman's driving, punching out was my calling card. You know, I always thought of it as my great equalizer.
Yeah, well, that's important. No problem at all. Here's one. Provisional balls hit, and I noticed one time you hit 23 provisionals in just 36 holes.
Yeah, my guys at Molitor weren't too happy after that tournament, for sure.
Probably not. Consecutive shots hit from the same spot?
You know, yeah, that's true, but, you know, I'm sorry, but a 220-yard force carry is a lot to ask, even for a tour pro, you know. In that situation, after the first four shots, Ernesto just dropped a small pile down for him, and it just kind of felt like a mini range sesh.
Okay. Here's one. This one caught my eye. Other fairways hit?
That's true, but in fairness, that was before I started playing my double cross.
Okay. Whiffs?
That's an unofficial stat, but yes.
Wow. Okay. Chips double and triple hit?
Guilty.
Wow. Putts double hit?
Yeah, you know, especially the close ones, you know, I would get really wristy under the gun.
Oh, okay. Consecutive cuts missed?
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of people have said, you know, that streak is as impressive as Tiger's consecutive cuts made streak. And really, for me, anytime I'm compared to Tiger, I'll take it.
Yeah. It's always good to be compared to him, yeah. And lastly, I saw DUIs.
Yeah, and really that's even more impressive when you realize that the legal limit in Mexico is, at the time, was 0.3.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, that is impressive. Now, when did you realize that you should turn your talents to the club pro world?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I can pinpoint an exact moment. You know, I think for me and for a lot of athletes in the twilight of the career, it's more of a combination of moments that tell you it's time. And in my final year on tour, you know, a lot of little things started adding up that told me maybe it was time, you know, like the time I missed the cut in a no-cut event, you know, or you know, when I started noticing the officials in the scoring tent weren't even bothering to add up my scores, you know, that told me something. When my playing partner started screaming four right just before I'd make impact, you know, that was kind of a red flag. You know, when I started regripping my ball retriever more often than my driver, you know, when I started getting shots from my amateur pro-am partners, you know, that told me something. You know, after I would double hit a chip, my playing competitors would say great shot and mean it. You know, when I started doing mega fist pumps after making bogey putts, you know, that's something I didn't do early on in my career. you know, kind of a sad one, when my mental game slash attitude coach committed suicide. Wow. You know, devastating. And that actually was probably the straw that broke the camel's back. But any of these on their own wouldn't have been a big deal, you know. But when you put them all together, it definitely told me it was time.
Yeah. Okay. What did you have any mentors that kind of led you to being a club pro?
Well, you know, I'd say my main mentor was the head pro at the course I grew up as a kid. You know, he was a pro's pro. He was one of those rare guys that had it all going for him, you know, kind of the epitome of cool. You know, he drove a Corvette with dealer tags. He wore transition lenses way before Kenny Perry made wearing transition lenses cool. He had a bullseye putter with a Michelob logo engraved on it.
That's cool.
You know, he wore a belt. You know, his teaching method was interesting. He had a real Harvey Penick quality about him. He would just observe and just soak up information. I remember he used to watch me hit balls for what seemed like hours, and then kind of out of nowhere, he would just drop a pearl of wisdom like your ball flight looks like the dump I took at Jiffy Lube this morning. Or you know, maybe, does your mom know I accept methods of payment other than money? You know, stuff like that. You know, I think the fact that he buttoned the top button on his golf shirt gave the appearance to the members that he was a solid head pro that could be trusted. But in reality, his two main functions was ordering Tommy Armour 845s that came in the front door and went right out the back, and using the club phone to call 900 numbers almost nonstop. But, you know, the lessons he gave me are huge, and they're ones that I employ even to this day.
Now, the transition's always tough. Was it an easy transition from the grind, which, you know, the grind of playing professionally, to teaching and being a steward of the game as you are now?
Well, Tripp, I was lucky.
Right.
Because, you know, I had so many options when I retired. You know, and I'm not going to say it's an exact parallel, but I think I felt a little bit like Greg Norman did when he stopped playing, in the fact that I had a lot of different avenues I could go down. You know, like a lot of other big-time players, my initial focus was to get my golf course design business up and running. You know, I developed a real passion for golf course architecture ever since somebody told me that Tom Fazio makes over $1 million in design. You know, unfortunately, that business kind of fizzled quickly after I found out that one of those fancy drafting tables costs like $2,800. So, you know, I had to kind of move on to other things, and I was lucky because I had a ton of doors open for me in the corporate world. You know, the Nevada Bobs in Lubbock offered me a retail position. Several multi-level marketing companies made really strong plays. The Golf Tech franchise in Wichita practically stalked me. You know, I'm not going to name any names, but I was offered maintenance positions at some of the big boy courses. But I declined them all because, you know, I really believe that being a club pro is in my blood, and I would never, ever, ever leave it for under any circumstances unless somebody came along and offered me like $3,000 more than I'm making now, which I doubt would happen.
Yeah, probably not. Now, this is always interesting because I like to kind of put myself in your shoes and what your routine is, and take us through like a typical Saturday in CPG's life.
Well, for me, Saturdays, especially in season, is all about the double Ds, which is dodge and disappear. And this is a working method I developed many years ago that works really well for me. And, you know, the minute the members start to show up, I implement the first of the double Ds, which is dodge. And this is when I'm going to do anything I can to avoid the members. And you might ask why. And the reason is it's beyond painful to talk to them, okay? You know, you're trying out a new driver today, don't care. You just got back from a golf trip to Ireland, don't care. You feel like some weather might be moving in, don't care, okay? This is typically around the time I'm gonna grab a golf cart and slowly drive the course and act like I'm concerned about course setup or pace of play. You know, it doesn't really matter because at this point it's just all about killing time. Now, around 1 o'clock, I'm going to implement the second and most important D, which is disappear. Now, this is usually the time of day when I tell my staff I've got a four-hour punch-out lesson on the back of the range or maybe a ball retriever fitting session, when in reality, you know, I'm going to head down to our club's above-ground pool to watch the ladies' water aerobics class. You know, this is typically going to be the highlight of my day. Now, late in the afternoon, I might give the members a thrill by teeing it up in the Saturday night nine-hole men's league. You know, every time I break 40, there's a real buzz about it in the shop the next day. By then, it's time to drop the top on the Miata and head to Chili's for about 9 Zimas and a mix-and-match rib platter. You know, after that, my head usually hits the futon about midnight, and five and a half hours later, I'm up to do it all over again.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's amazing. What a day. Have you ever made any students better?
Well, that's a great question, and I think a lot of that depends on how you define the term better. You know, if you mean objectively lowering a student's handicap, the answer is probably no, but golf instruction is a two-way street. You know, I can be the best teacher in the world, but I can't hit the shots.
Right.
You know, that's on you. And you also have to remember who I'm forced to work with. Okay, trust me, it's not pretty. You know, you take a guy like Ledbetter who gets all the accolades. You know, he gets a 15-year-old South Korean that's already a +3 handicap come work with him. Okay, I get an out-of-shape housewife whose most athletic move in the last 20 years is sidestepping the salad bar at Golden Corral. Okay, imagine Hillary Clinton in a skort and a cutter and buck sleeveless shirt deciding to take up golf at her advanced age. Okay, that's who I get to work with on a daily basis. So you're going to have to excuse me if I don't get the same results as Ledbetter. Now, that being said, my total game improvement package is pretty straightforward. You know, for the long game, I teach a very basic flat five plane swing. You know, I think any more planes than that is information overload. You know, I like to keep it simple. For the short game, I'm going to introduce you to my stack and jilt chipping method, which promotes leading edge turf first contact with a last second jilt to save the shot. You know, it's great for extremely fluffy lies and chips with a lot of green to work with. And then last but certainly not least is my proprietary 747 swing thought system, right, which as you know, Tripp, is a series of 18 simple swing thoughts that must be recited in order during the course of the golf swing. So the full package is a 2-year commitment that runs $6,600, but it does include a 2-hole playing lesson and a sleeve of top flight tri-metal golf balls. So obviously it's a popular program, and I think the results speak for themselves.
Okay. Oh, that's, wow. That's quite a package there, no question about that. Now, I do understand there's some legal issues surrounding your junior camps.
Mm-hmm.
But once that's behind you, which I think you're confident it will be put behind you, I know you're looking forward to working with the juniors again.
Well, the whole thing's a mess. It's just a total mess. And I can't divulge a lot right now because it's an ongoing investigation.
Right.
But I will say that while we're busy obsessing over whether I did or didn't drive my junior campers to a gentleman's club, Japan is busy producing 1,000 Hideki Matsuyamas, okay? Is that what we want? You know, is that what the USGA wants? You know, I don't think so. You know, the whole issue for me goes way back. You know, ever since the Kansas City chapter of the First Tee Foundation suspended me for helping the kids start up a small-time sports book operation, I've been labeled as a bad influence. And really, that breaks my heart. You know, the sad thing is they don't realize that by punishing me, they're actually punishing the kids. You know, and I'm going to continue to say this to anyone willing to listen, and I'll scream it from the rooftops. Aside from the work I do with single moms and divorced women, nothing is more important to me than juniors. You know, and I feel confident that once I get assigned a public defender and the legal process plays out and all the smoke clears, you know, I'm going to be able to get back to doing what I do best, which is teaching juniors real life lessons like calculating Nassaus, handicap manipulation, and out of proportion emotional outbursts.
Oh, yeah, okay. Important skills in golf, no question. What's your most popular clinic each year?
Well, I'd say since I don't have health insurance, it's probably the health clinic downtown. you know, for extra money, I donate plasma and sperm at the BioLife Clinic in Midtown.
No, I'm talking golf clinic.
Oh, golf. Okay. Most popular is probably, I know I crossed the hazard 80 yards back, but I'm going to play dumb and just drop it here clinic. My 10 ways to throw your four ball partner under the bus clinic is really popular. Fist pumping for dummies, always attended well, you know. My adjusting your pre-shot routine based on level of nervousness clinic is a hot one. My selecting a member guest partner, those with a legitimate handicap need not apply clinic is popular, especially in the spring before member guest season. One of my biggest ones is 10 keys to hitting provisional tee balls long and straight. You know, so those are some of my most popular.
All right. I know there's always kind of tension between the club pro and the GM in the club pro world. So how well do you get along with your general manager?
Horribly. Horrible. I mean, honestly, you know, the guy is worthless. You know, he's probably, nope, not probably, he is the single biggest factor holding this club back. You know, the main problem is the guy just doesn't understand the golf business. You know, case in point, last spring he interviewed a man for the beverage cart job. I mean, who does that? Who does that? I've never heard of that. You know, just because he has an associate's degree, he thinks he's so smart. He's always patronizing me by trying to give me life tips. Like when he tells me I should probably get auto insurance, or when he says that it doesn't make economic sense for me to rent my furniture. You know, okay, thanks, Dad, but I think I can handle $29 a week. You know, this is the same guy who decided to take tasers away from our course marshals. You know, they're completely unarmed. You know, now players break the 90-degree rule at will. You know, we got carts going everywhere. It's a joke. You know, it puts our marshals in more of a defensive posture on patrol now. You know, they don't feel like they're equipped to do the job. You know, a few weeks ago, we had a marshal confront a group for having outside purchased beverages, and all he was able to do was verbally assault them. You know, so it's sad, and quite frankly, you know, it's dangerous. So for the good of the club, I'm doing everything I can to get him fired, you know, along with appealing my Midwest Section PGA suspension and paying off my O2 Miata. It's one of my top priorities for 2018.
Good to hear. Now, your course is known to have some of the best temporary greens in your area.
It's true.
How much do you have to do with that, or is that all on your superintendent?
Well, as you might or might not know, our course is a classic 1985 Hank Jones design. You know, Hank was an intern at the Kansas City Parks and Rec Department when he built the course, and this was his first and ultimately last design. And in fact, a little bit of trivia for those design nerds who might be listening. Hank is the only modern American golf course architect in the world that is currently employed at a Carl's Jr. You know, just a factoid there. But anyway, Hank lacked even the most basic knowledge of common design concepts like drainage, runoff, erosion, or really anything related at all to turf management. So consequently, we have areas on our golf course that are completely unsuitable for standard greens. So under my leadership, you know, we as a club launched a massive capital improvements campaign to refurbish our three temporary greens. And before his arrest and subsequent deportation, I worked in collaboration with our superintendent, Javier, to add some unique design features like false fronts and grass, you know, and the results. And I think if you talk to my members, they'll say the same thing. The results have been nothing short of spectacular. You know, when you get temporary greens as pure as ours, you know, the debate naturally becomes, do you play them as an auto two putt or do you go ahead and hole everything out? So I called Pine Valley and Oakmont, you know, as well as the USGA to see how they handle similar situations, and I haven't heard back yet. But we actually have the ability to get them rolling pretty good. You know, I remember for the club championships this year, they stemmed out at a one, which, as you know, Tripp, is pretty slick for temporary greens. They can get a little grainy, You know, but I think that's part of the challenge for the better players. And from a maintenance perspective, you know, our greens are, the temp greens are like any other greens. You have to be careful because you don't want to scalp them and risk losing them, especially in the summer. But it's a balancing act. But I think that's why being a superintendent can be a thankless job.
Yeah, it can be, no question. Now, later this month, we're in Orlando, of course, and later this month, the PGA Show, the annual PGA Show, one of the biggest initiatives the PGA does each year for the Club Pro World and for golf, really.
Right.
And tell us, you know, about your annual trips here to Orlando to the PGA Merchandise Show.
Well, I mean, what a resource the PGA Show is for our profession. You know, as a PGA member, to me, the merchandise show is a unique opportunity for me to walk the tightrope of learning, teaching, collaborating, and getting blackout drunk four nights in a row. You know, I honestly don't know what it is about Orlando. You know, every time I come down here, I'm like Lamar Odom in a pair of triple pleated Dockers. You know, when Rachel's Orlando puts your name up on the marquee, I mean, you know things are about to get real. Now, as far as the show itself goes, when I'm inside the convention center, it's all business. You know, I obviously spend a ton of time in the Castle Bay Iron Cover booth because I'm on staff with them and they want me to press the flesh with some of their heavy hitters. Other than that, I just like to walk the show and look for unique member guest tee prizes for the upcoming season. I mean, last year I found a faux leather valuables pouch for ball markers and tees and whatnot that was really hot. This year I'm going to be on the lookout for a white golf towel that has 2018 member guest imprinted on it in block lettering. You know, unique items that show the members I went the extra mile. You know, other than that, I try to set aside time to rub elbows with some industry insiders. You know, last year I used a urinal right next to Tim Rosefort. You know, back in 08, I saw Kelly Tillman and Rich Lerner in the valet line outside the convention center. In 2012, I saw Michael Breed kind of milling around the food court area. I always run into Aaron Oberholzer in the bar at the Chili's on International Drive. You know, Aaron cracks me up. Every time that XE1 wedge commercial comes on, he screams for everybody in the bar to be quiet. I mean, you know, that guy loves that wedge. Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, it's kind of a who's who for me down here. Now, I also like to get some golf in. You know, it's not all work, and I like to take advantage of the warm weather and just knock some rust off my game. I've got a relationship with some head pros at some of the municipal tracks in and around Orlando, which is huge. You know, they typically only charge me a cart fee if I play after 2 o'clock because I'm a PGA member, which is great. But overall, the show is a great opportunity for me to educate myself and others, you know, blow off a little steam and make a little extra money by just completely falsifying my expense report.
Wow. Well, you know what? That's amazing information from CPG. So before I let you go, let's have a little fun here. I analyze golfers for a living. That's what I do now here at Golf Channel. So I want you to come into my world. I mean, you know so much about the game, okay? Incredible knowledge. And I'd just like to get your analysis of, you know, a few of the top players in the game and evaluate, like, their 2017s, and let's spin it forward to this year and just do an overall analysis of some of the top players. So let's start with world number one DJ, Dustin Johnson.
Well, it's funny you mention him because I was just breaking down DJ's swing recently preparing for a senior ladies driver off the deck clinic, and in my prep, I stumbled on something interesting. I don't know if you know this, Trip, but he has a bowed left wrist at the top of the swing. You know, I caught this on YouTube in slow-mo, and I laughed because this is something that none of the so-called top 100 teachers have noticed, you know, and it's something I caught. And looking at that, you know, I see that the bowed left wrist may be great for driving it really long and really straight, but he'll never win at Colonial with that swing, you know. So ultimately, to me, it's problematic. You know, he probably won't reach out to me because I'm based in the Midwest and he's down in South Florida. You know, I get that. But But if he did, I would advise a complete swing tear down and rebuild with an eye towards 2020.
Wow. All right, let's go to Justin Thomas.
Well, you know, JT has a lot of natural talent, but in my opinion, I think he needs to do a little better job with consistency. You know, I'm not going to sit here and bag on the guy's season, but he can't run and hide from the fact that he missed the cut at the Valspar. You know, so I think he needs to tighten that up a little bit. I also worry a little bit about his lack of distance. I just think he should go after the tee ball a little harder, be a little more aggressive. You know, I've actually reached out to his camp, but I haven't heard back. You know, I know his dad's a club pro, and I would never want to step on his toes, but I would love to get JT on my lesson tee for just 18 to 24 months to see if I can get him to be a little more mechanical.
All right, let's go to young Mr. Spieth, Jordan Spieth.
Well, you know, the putting stroke's a concern for me. In my humble opinion, anyone who resorts to putting cross-handed is letting out a cry for help. You know, none of the greats from the 90s putted cross-handed. You know, J. Don Blake, Matt Gogel, John Houston, you know, none of them. So I don't see what makes Spieth think he can do it. I'm not saying he can't, but it's risky. You know, the other thing is, I don't know if you know this, but he doesn't even look at the ball on the shorter putts. You know, I just feel like he's kind of relying on gimmicks, you know, to keep his game together. It reminds me a little bit of when I briefly tried to use a split grip with the driver. You know, it looked great on the range, but really tough to do under the gun. You know, I'll just say this. I wouldn't want to be Cameron McCormick when his game comes crashing down, because I think it's probably going to happen.
All right. Ricky Fowler.
Well, you know, Ricky's an enigma to me. You know, I think because he has so many difficulties attracting women in his personal life, he lets that frustration carry on to the golf course. You know, I also see he's doing Farmers Insurance commercials now, so obviously there's some trouble financially. You know, I think his tattoos are a cry for help. You know, I mean, the guy gets an Olympic rings tattoo like he's Bonnie Blair, and then he goes out and doesn't even medal. You know, he hasn't reached out to me, but if he did, I would just tell him to get a little more comfortable in his own skin, you know, maybe trim his eyebrows a little bit. You know, I think if he did those things, he would gain some more acceptance on tour, and that elusive first major will eventually come.
Well, Club Pro Guy, always nice to hear your insights and your story. Thanks for joining us here at Golf Channel, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.